Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you tardily, I know, by Microsoft, a small company. They make a little product called Windows. Very quaint stuff. We're hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting at greatly discounted rates. Thank you, Vigabyte. And we've got a great show this week. My liver is still recovering, sadly, from Australia's best technical security conference, RuxCon. It wrapped up on Sunday, and it was the biggest RuxCon ever run by far. There were around 400 payers through the doors in the end. Add to that the speakers, their partners, and everyone else, and it was a pretty jam-packed weekend. In fact, it was so jam-packed that it took me a few days to recover, which is why this week's podcast is late. Apologies for that. Now, in this week's show, we'll be chatting to RuxCon attendee and speaker Mark Dowd to wrap up the two-day event. And there were some extremely interesting presentations at the conference, and you'll really want to stick around to hear what they were about. In fact, Mark actually did one of the talks, one of the better ones also. And for those of you who don't know who Mark Dowd is, he's actually a prominent security researcher with IBM ISS in Sydney. We'll also check in this week with Microsoft's Julia Atala in this week's sponsor interview. Julia's Microsoft's Director of Product Marketing for Online Services and Windows, and she'll be along to talk about Morro, the company's free AV product, which is planned for release next year, and that's designed explicitly for consumers. So we can't get excited because the company has no plans to start handing freebie antivirus out to the enterprise. Now, before we get into our weekly news segment with ZDNet Australia's editor Mania Kataria, I should just mention some news that's crossed my desk regarding VMware. Listeners to last week's program would have heard the feature interview with Adam Poynton and Neil Wise in regard to a guest-to-master flaw found in the Citrix Xen hypervisor. Geez, wouldn't it be bad if something similar was found in VMware, we said. Well, guess what? An advisory and patch have just popped out detailing what could be just that. Apparently, the Department of Defense in the USA has found a flaw in VMware, whereby, and I quote, a malicious request sent from the guest operating system to the virtual hardware may cause the virtual hardware to write to uncontrolled physical memory. Now, look, they haven't just come out and said it, but I suspect the odds are about even that the bug is exploitable. Now, I wish Risky Business could claim credit for putting that one on the agenda and getting it disclosed quick smart, but given the patch came out 8 days after our podcast, my guess is it had been in the works for a while. So, alas, we're not that influential, but it's interesting news nonetheless and a worthy follow-up to last week's discussion around that Xen flaw. Anyway, it's time to speak to Mania Kataria from ZDNet Australia about the week's news. And this week, Mania, we're a bit light on news because of the Thanksgiving holiday in the USA, but we can start with this story. And it's funny because the reason I pulled this one out is because I did actually come across this this story which claimed that you could use some sort of cross-site scripting nastiness to basically create Gmail filters on people's accounts. And I, to tell you the truth, I looked at the story and thought, you know what, I reckon I'm going to wait until someone verifies that before I start talking about it on the show. And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did because it turned out that the guy was full of shit.
So it seems. That's right. I mean, the original story came out at the end of November, about 23rd or so of November. And it seemed, it was reported that the attackers could use filters on email accounts without their knowledge and play with their emails. But it's saying, well, Google is saying, oh, no, these guys were just victims of a phishing attack.
Yeah, so these guys reckon that a couple of their domains got wrested away from them. And, you know, they thought that they'd been caught in some really sophisticated, like, cross-site request forgery badness. You know, via some sort of website that was under Google's control. But it looks like what's actually happened is that they've been phished and they've not realized it.
And the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, they were fraudulent. The website, one of the domains that was set up was google-hosts.com. You know, I mean, that may have had something to do with it. It just shows that nobody is beyond getting hooked on these things.
Mm-mm. Well, I remember there was one going around a while ago based in Malaysia. It was a malware-serving joint. Was google-analysis.com.
Right.
Which obviously, like, what they were doing is embedding malicious code in, like, people's, you know, PHP websites and stuff. It was, I don't know, some sort of injection thing, whatever. going around and like embedding that stuff in there so that it just looked like Google Analytics code.
Mm.
So I'm kind of surprised that Google hasn't gone around and just, you know, maybe spent a few grand registering these sort of domain names. But, you know, you can't get them all, can you?
No, you can't. There's loads of them. I find it really interesting, though, that Google, it says at the end of the story, Google reminded users to enter Gmail signing credentials only at web addresses starting with HTTPS and then google.com/accounts. And it says they should not ignore warnings their browsers may raise regarding certificates.
Yes, yes.
Now, if we all of us paid attention to all of those warnings, what would we ever do? I don't think we'd ever get through the day.
Yeah, well, I don't. Well, certificate warnings, you know, I don't see too many of them. Although I do have to say that I, you know, we discussed one on the show a couple of weeks ago, which was F5 Networks.
Right.
They make SSL load balancers, yep, for God's sakes, and one of their download sites had an expired certificate. So it does happen, but, you know, that's the problem, isn't it? I think we've well and truly discredited SSL as, like, a magic hacker-proof way of, like, transferring information around safely, because you can just scam people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I just found the scam, you know, when I read about it, I thought, gee, that's interesting if it's the case, but they were basically saying that there was some sort of trickery where people could put filters on your account and then, you know, try to force password resets. So the filter could actually forward your mail to someone else and then delete it, so you'd never see it, and it would go to someone else. So if they sent a password reset to your account or whatever, they could retrieve information that way. Yeah,
so we've heard nothing more from this guy, Brandon, who actually wrote it up in his log.
Not yet, but we'll just have to wait and see if he comes back and says, nah.
Come on, Brandon.
That's right. That's right. Now, just a bit of news that we don't see very often these days. There's a new network worm doing the rounds, which exploits a Windows vulnerability, which is, alas, a vulnerability for which a patch exists.
But, that's right. It's MS08-067.
Yes.
I like this. This kind of like goes back to 4 or 5 years ago.
I know.
One of the great things about this is, you know, that excellent move by the malware writers here. You know, one of the things that their worm actually does is it patches the vulnerable API in the memory. So the machine is not vulnerable anymore, which means that it can't be taken over by a rival worm. This is exactly the kind of behavior we used to see, you know, when we had the Bagel and Midium and Netsky and all of that lot fighting each other because they kept making sure that they'd patch the machine. And then there was all the debate about would it be a good worm. But
yeah, well, I it's interesting here. I mean, the report says that most of the infections are in the US. And, you know, you'd think really in the US people would have patched this thing that was, you know, there was a patch released for this in October. So kind of interesting to know that people still don't patch. Then again, maybe they're just using non-genuine software and, you know.
I know somebody who would probably come up with that.
Yeah,
Interesting. Another interesting thing is in this report that the worm avoids infecting Ukrainian computers.
Oh, well, maybe that tells us something, Manir. What do you reckon?
Yeah, the attackers are all from Denmark.
That's right, absolutely. Hey, look, before we get to the next story, there's a little bit of news that's doing the rounds at the moment. I only found this out because Dave emailed me, but David Litchfield, who owns or runs you know, NGS Software, he's, of course, you know, a very well-known database hacker. He was the guy who found like 40 O-days in Oracle. The day after or 2 days after they released their Unbreakable campaign, which was a very nice bit of Dave-ness there.
But Larry loves him, yes.
Yes, absolutely. He's sold NGS for £10 million.
£10 million?
Yeah, no, I wish, you know, like that'd be cool. But I wrote him an email back. He actually bought me a... you know, at Auscert, they've got the teppanyaki joint, and he ordered, like, lobster teppanyaki. And, you know, I actually wrote back to him and said, you know, now that you're a 10 million squidionaire, I'm feeling less guilty about you paying for my lobster teppanyaki.
So he bought that before they bought you up, before they bought him up.
Yeah, but he must have been doing okay.
I guess so.
But he'll be coming out to Auscert again, apparently. But, he sold NGS to some company called NCC Group. So there you go.
Good on him, man. He's a very smart chap.
Yes, and he's a nice bloke as well, I'm sure, you know. A lot of people. He's quite well known in Australia as well because NGS do have a presence here.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a presence in Brisbane, and Dave's always out here. So, yeah, congratulations, Dave Litchfield.
Good on you, mate.
Moving on, we had Kimberly Zenz on the program a couple of weeks ago predicting that spam volumes would recover following the shutdown of McColo, which was obviously a nasty data center that ran command and control for botnets and really helped the spam machinery tick over. She predicted that it would bounce back, that spam volumes would bounce back. They did drop by, you know, 70% after McColo had the pin pulled on it, and sure enough, they're on their way back up.
Yeah, absolutely. Message Labs is saying that they're coming up and rising very, very quickly. They're about what does it say here? Since Sunday, spam volume has risen to about 37% of what they were before it was unplugged.
Yeah, so we're still down. Well, I mean, that's Message Lab statistics. Everyone's got their own, obviously. But they all seem roughly commensurate, you know. But
there was a really, really sad bit in the story, though. I don't know. It's probably just me. But it says here that all of the bots, which, you know, were connecting to the system, and it says, with no work orders to process, the machine simply stopped spamming. Kind of makes me feel sorry for the infected PCs. It's like, the spam master doesn't love me anymore.
They've got nothing to do.
No.
They're just sitting around, you know, idle.
Yeah.
Very annoying.
It's sad.
It is. It is. Think of all that human endeavor wasted, you know, and, you know, machine endeavor as well, I guess. Now, of course, it looks like they've popped back up on an Estonian ISP. That's the gist I get from this story. And the problem now, of course, is that it's more difficult to shut down something based somewhere like, say, Estonia than it is to shut down a company like Mikola, which was based in the US. But that said, they operated without any trouble for 2 years. They operated from 2006 to 2008. So I don't know that that's a reasonable assertion, because they did really not have much trouble trading in the States.
I've always thought that there's been something very wrong, that the majority of spam was sent from the US. You know, it just doesn't seem quite right. It makes it easier for the spammers, etc. But, you know, from a law enforcement point of view, it just seems wrong. So if the spam is coming from some Eastern European country like that, then at least it makes it more... Well, it just seems... Okay, I understand that. I believe that. It's fair enough. But if it's coming from the States, then come on, you should be able to shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they didn't. They have now, but, you know, there you go.
Let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens. But it looks like it's all on the way back up. And that's something that Kimberly said the other week, which is that, you know, one advantage of having all of these guys in the one spot is you could track and you could monitor. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And they're always going to have, they're fun. And pretty much, and just hope this doesn't drive innovation. Now, our final story here. This came, I can't even remember where I scooped this one off. I think I might have got it off news.com or, you know, God.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think I got this off news.com. But Europe is tackling cybercrime, Mania. Europe has the whole cybercrime thing nutted.
They've got it sussed.
They're hitting the nail on the head right now in one foul swoop to get rid of cybercrime.
They've got a great name for their enforcement body. It's called Europol. And they're going to spend €3 billion. I mean, €300,000.
That's right. They're spending €300,000 on a cybercrime alert system for Europe.
No, look, I did some incredible amount of research.
I'm quite worried, mate, because, you know, I think we could be out of a job soon.
Look, I did some incredible research on this, as I do for this show always, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I typed in €300,000 into Google just to see what you could buy with that.
Yeah, what can you buy with that?
Okay, apparently in a Russian car wash, somebody found a diamond pendant worth €300,000.
Maybe that's how they funded this. But go on. was it a Europol undercover car wash?
That's how they're getting the cash across.
That's right.
You could get a spacious detached villa with a pool in Alicante for €300,000.
Shit, that sounds like a pretty good deal, actually.
But listen to this. The Finnish government spent €300,000 funding a horror film. Called Dark Floors.
Called what?
Dark Floors.
Nice.
Okay. I'm reading this in Wiki News, so it can't be wrong.
Okay. No, that's pretty good. What else could €300,000 possibly
do?
You could buy a nice car.
That was the total of my extensive research.
Well, I'm glad you did it, Manir, because I think that was very, very relevant, very pertinent.
But Europe is going to stop cybercrime with that. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, look, it is an interesting story here. What they're going to do is build an alert system that pulls reports of cybercrime, such as online identification and financial theft, from across 27 member states. So, you know, it sounds like one of those little things that's worth doing, but I just can't believe that someone actually thought writing a press release on this thing was a good idea. You know, you've got to be pretty hard up when you're touting your latest €300,000 initiative, you know?
I'm surprised they could afford to buy somebody to actually write their press release for them.
I mean, that would not even cover McAfee's stationery budget. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, Mun, that takes us to the end of this week's news, mate. But thank you very much for taking some time out, as always, to have a chat to us.
It's been a pleasure, mate. Thanks very much.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Katadia there, and we'll be right back in 30 seconds.
Sick of running web filtering on your gateway? Sick of legitimate sites being blocked by overzealous web filters? Do your users whinge? Message Lab's web security services filters the badness out of your web feed in the cloud, intercepting web-borne threats before they get anywhere near your network. Plus, our web usage reports track users by bandwidth and URLs visited, so IT can budget for web usage costs by department. Let web filtering be our problem, not yours. Find out more at messagelabs.com.au.
Thanks to Message Labs, incidentally, for their support. I should let you all know that these extra ads in the show are temporary. Message Labs has been kind enough to place a campaign with us so we can raise a bit of extra cash to pump into the new and improved website we'll be launching next year at the fabulous domain name of risky.biz. There'll be forums, a blog with industry contributors, a second podcast for conference audio, and all sorts of good stuff. Anyway, it's time now to get the lowdown on RuxCon, Sydney's technical security conference. It's a bit like Black Hat or DEF CON or even KiwiCon, which you've heard us report on before. It's a fun environment where all sorts of security types, from consultants to professionals to in-house guys to just enthusiasts, they all get together and nerd out while utterly destroying their livers with cheap booze. In other words, it's awesome. I recorded a few interviews and talks at the conference, which I'll be using in the next few shows. But first up, we thought it would make sense to recap the conference and talk about the basics, what was shown, what the highlights were, because there were some really great talks over the two-day event with some, you know, pretty interesting implications, I think. So joining me now is IBM ISS researcher and conference attendee Mark Dowd. Mark is a fairly well-known, well, very well-known security researcher, and he was at RuxCon to hang out and attend a few talks. So Mark, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the presentations that happened at RuxCon. I know you couldn't make it to all of them, but one of the ones that I caught that I found personally quite interesting was this talk that Graham Nielsen did on developing Trojan firmware for Juniper devices running ScreenOS. Did you hear anything about that one?
That was actually one of the ones I wasn't able to make it to. I was helping out the staff a little bit as well. So, but everyone said it was really good, and I'm quite annoyed that I missed it, actually.
Well, the news gets better. I do actually have it on tape, so I think I'll be podcasting that one at some point. But yeah, look, basically what they found is that Juniper's ScreenOS doesn't actually check to see if packages are signed, firmware packages are signed. So it's quite easy to actually subvert the ScreenOS if you've already exploited something on it. I mean, you might be able to get stuff on there remotely if you wait for the admin to initiate an update and then you give them a bad update. But he completely reversed engineered the binary formats. And, you know, it seemed like a pretty nifty trick. But look, even though you didn't see the talk, I've got to ask, I mean, this seems like a pretty nasty spot to get a Trojan, doesn't it, inside a sort of network or firewall device?
Yeah, it's very serious. And, like I said, I didn't see it, but if he was saying that they didn't actually validate the firmwares that they were uploading, that seems like a massive oversight because, like you said, you would be able to not just hack the machine and put one on yourself, but you also may be able to modify ones in transit or something like that. And it would be very dangerous because it would very likely go unnoticed by administrators and all that kind of stuff, and you could do all sorts of bad things to someone's network. You could take it out, you could add additional routes, you could sniff traffic, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about this Prezo, is it wasn't anything particularly groundbreaking. Do you know what I mean? He just reverse engineered a firmware format, but I guess it got people thinking about, you know, hey, if that did actually happen, that would be a pretty nasty one because it would just be so stealthy.
Yeah. It's also not always about what's particularly groundbreaking or not, but like what impact it will have on business in this particular case, because it's stealthy and because it's at the choke point of your network and one of the most major components of it, being able to control that device stealthily would be pretty dangerous.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of stealth, possibly my favorite talk from the con, or definitely one of my favorite talks from the conference, was by a guy called Bern Campbell, who did one on subverting local networks using, what is it, OSPF?
Yeah, OSPF. I did see this talk. It was actually really interesting. He talked about a number of techniques centered around using OSPF. He basically wrote a couple of tools where he was able to map out the network from listening to OSPF traffic, do passive reconnaissance, and also do active interception and even updating routes for the network and stuff like that.
Yeah, now this talk I thought was exceptional because really what he was talking about is doing, it was like a layer two sort of network topology mapping tool, wasn't it? So you didn't even need an IP. You could just sort of sit there listening and get heaps of information on the network that you were attached to.
Yeah, he was able to actually, you know, map out, you know, large portions of the network just by listening. And his tool actually would go ahead and even graph out the network topology that he'd discovered, which I thought was kind of neat.
Yeah, it was. And again, I mean, this is an attack that's sort of known to be, you know, viable for a long time. But here we have a case where a guy's actually come in, done the research and written a tool to make this stuff practical. So I thought it was just, you know, it didn't have to be brand new research. It was the implementation part that I found quite interesting, which I believe also included an MD5 cracker for the OSPF password hashes.
Yeah. He demonstrated that technique, because he said that they weren't using MD5 particularly effectively when they made OSPF. But also, the tool he wrote was actually quite in depth. It had a lot of different little components that all worked together to make, you know, not just discovery of the network, but being able to inject routes and all that kind of stuff. So he kind of packaged it all into one thing. And if you're doing penetration testing or something like that, I think it would actually be a pretty valuable addition to, you know, your toolkit.
Now, of course, OSPF is a standard routing protocol that a lot of people use. Another thing I found quite interesting in this talk is that because it's sort of unconventional, the way that he was doing this, especially the man in the middle stuff and injecting routes, you know, you'd know it was there if you were looking for it. But nothing looks for this stuff, does it?
No, well, he seemed to indicate that nothing at this stage is looking for it. Certainly, like a lot of products don't focus on, you know, OSPF and maybe other routing protocols too much. But he was also quite concerned during the talk with not just security products, but even like their standard logging features of your typical, you know, routing devices that utilize OSPF. So he was quite clear about if this and that, you won't generate log messages, but if you do something else, then you might generate some log messages. So it is quite stealthy, and he went out of his way to, you know, talk about the parts that were more stealthy versus things that would make more noise on the network.
Yeah, like ARP spoofing. I mean, that's the standard trick that everyone sort of pulls out of the bag, and it is one that people watch for. So it's a great new tool, and certainly I think it's one that's going to catch on. It's written as an extension to Scappy, so it's called Ghost Recon. So people, if they want, can check it out. I've also got an interview with Byrne that we can have a look at, and I had a chat to him afterwards, and I, you know, it just occurred to me too that when you're injecting stuff in that way, what would be really cool is you could actually inject malware into someone's browser session and make it look like it came from outside, which I thought was also a nifty little trick.
Yeah. You'd be able to do all kinds of stuff, and it'll be good. I haven't actually downloaded his tool yet, but it'll be interesting to play with that. And like I said, I think it's something that's missing from a lot of people that do penetration testing and stuff like that might find this a valuable addition if they haven't concentrated much on the routing infrastructure for some of the networks that they, you know, have to break into.
Mm-mm. Now, this talk, I didn't see you in there, but there was a talk done by Finbar Davies on just like a really nice little roundup of enterprise security. Did you happen to catch that one?
No, I didn't catch that one. How did it go?
It was actually pretty good. I mean, it was an overview of a lot of stuff that we did know, but with some really nice coalface sort of war stories. And he dropped some pretty interesting info in there about some iPhone nastiness as well, because they're starting to pop up everywhere, as we all know.
Yeah.
But, you know, what people don't realize is that certain network providers in Australia, Optus, for example, you know, if you're using an iPhone, it assigns you a real-world IP. Now, if you've jailbroken your iPhone and you've put SSH on it, guess what? You know, replacing the root password in a jailbroken iPhone is actually pretty difficult. You need to generate the hash and then write over the existing root password hash, I think, depending on the tools that you're using, right? So there's all these people out there who are running, like, you know, SSH on 22 with a known default root password. And the nice part is there's actually a port. It's like 62.043 or something, which is specific to the iPhone. So if you actually set Nmap just going nuts on these ranges, these real world ranges that they assign to mobile devices, and you find that port, if you then scan that host again, you might actually find one with SSH and be able to own it. And I thought that was probably the most interesting part of that talk.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty wide open free for all.
Oh, it sounds like a bit of fun.
I hope they do something about that.
Well, I think anyone who's like hacked their iPhone and put SSH on it and are using a default root password, I think they're kind of fair game, don't you?
Yeah, well, it certainly should be easier to fix, to change a password.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, it wasn't designed for command line stuff, so it's not Apple's fault. It's just all these guys who are, you know. All right, now another talk, which I know you didn't catch this one, which was on intelligent web fuzzing by a bloke called Neil Archibald and his missus. It was a husband and wife team.
I actually was at their wedding.
Oh, really? Okay, right. Friends with these guys. So do you know a little bit about their tool that they were talking about at RoxCon?
Yeah, I know a little bit. I spoke to Neil about it, and he said that him and Steph had been working on an idea of basically to hook various functions and stuff like that in PHP and web-based languages and stuff like that, and then basically launch a fuzzing tool against an application and catch it on the server side and see what kind of things are happening and whether there's a potential for, various types of vulnerabilities occurring when those functions are triggered with particular inputs.
Yeah, now that's what I found interesting is because I think a lot of the tools out there, I mean, you've got code auditing tools and you've also got black box fuzzers, but I don't think there's terribly many like white box fuzzers out there, are there, that actually you install on the host and then, you know, attack the web app through the web interface and then watch the output on the other end on the host. It seems on the server. It seems pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Like there are actually white boxing tools for different scenarios. Like there's been tools in the past where they'll, you know, you'll launch all kinds of input against a, you know, network server or something and then see if it crashes. But this one was particularly interesting because it hadn't really been done in the context of web applications, and it's not just like looking for something to crash or whatever. It's trying to find, you know, web vulnerabilities where you can execute commands and stuff like that, or you know, do some sort of SQL injection or, you know, potential cross-site scripting or all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, and I understand that they can also catch blind SQL injection because they're watching, you know, the output of certain processes and hooking into functions on the server as well.
Yeah, that's right, because they've got the visibility to look at what the server sees and how the server reacts to the input. They can more easily detect these vulnerabilities than you could if you were just doing a client-side based attack.
It's clever stuff, and I'll be providing information in coming weeks about where you can go and get that tool. I don't actually have the details. Yeah, the details are buried in an MP3 somewhere on my hard disk, so I'll have to dig them out for you guys. Now, Mark, the last talk that I wanted to speak about was, and I did see you in this one because you were the one doing it. You did a very similar talk to the one that you did at PacSec, which was around bypassing all of the tricky memory protection mechanisms in Vista.
Yeah, that's right. I spoke about bypassing the various memory protections in Vista in the context of a browser. And this particular talk focused on web languages, and I specifically talked about .NET and Java and the impact that those, the ability to execute that dynamic code in those languages helped you when you were trying to exploit memory corruption vulnerabilities.
Yeah, now the part that I found particularly interesting came towards the end of the talk where you introduced the concept of virtual shellcode.
Yeah, the virtual shellcode idea is essentially an idea that's intended to get around the restriction that DEP places on you. DEP basically doesn't let you execute native code when it's behaving the way it should. So it basically marks memory as non-executable so that you can put shellcode into the remote address space, but you can't actually execute it, which is the idea. So the virtual shellcode, instead of executing native code on the target processor, it will use a virtual machine such as Java's virtual machine or .NET's virtual machine to execute code for you, because basically that's what those machines are there to do. And if you use memory corruption to disable a verification on those virtual machines so that they're not checking whether they're actually allowed to do operations or not, you can essentially turn off their sandbox and then just execute Java code or execute .NET shell code instead of native code and have it do anything you want, just as if you were executing native code.
Yeah, now the thing that I liked also about this, I can't remember if that was in that part of the talk, but I think it was actually in the earlier part of the talk where you were talking about running native code. Native shell code is you can actually stuff it into memory using .NET and then, you know, it's going to randomize it and put it somewhere where you don't quite know, but you can actually ask it, tell me where my code is, and it does. Is that right?
Yeah, what the idea behind that was when you supply .NET code in a .NET control on a web page, it's actually supplied in MSIL, which is, you know, the virtual language, and it eventually gets interpreted, verified, and then compiled to native code, and the native code runs. So they generate these native code stubs in the browser that they're going to eventually run. And basically, you don't know exactly where they are. However, .NET itself has a certain way that you can retrieve the native address to where it puts this compiled code, because each method basically has an object called a method handle in .NET, and the method handle has a function called get function pointer, and you can just use that to get the native address of where the compiled code is, and it's located in memory that's marked read, write, and executable. So if you find a memory corruption bug, you can overwrite memory in that region and, you know, just modify the code a little bit and then, you know, basically have it do whatever you like.
The thing I loved about that, you know, that using that function to get that address and find out where your code is it's sort of like someone coming up to you and saying, I have stashed $1 million and you will never find it. And then you ask them, where did you put it? And they said, oh, it's over there.
Yeah. It's sort of a funny trick. And basically, that function probably shouldn't be exposed over the web. The thing is, the .NET framework is very, very large and has a lot of different stuff that's useful in various contexts, but only some of it should be accessible from the web. And this is one of those functions that probably might have uses in different contexts, but over the web, it probably shouldn't be exposed and be allowed to be used by untrusted third parties.
Okay, well, I enjoyed your talk very much, Mark Dowd. Thank you very much for coming onto the show to recap RuxCon for us.
Thanks a lot. No problem.
RuxCon speaker Mark Dowd there with a recap of last weekend's RuxCon conference in Sydney. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview. Each week, we get our sponsors on the show to chat about something that's going on that's relevant to them. And this week, that's not hard because this week's sponsor is Microsoft. By now, pretty much everyone has heard the big news. Microsoft plans to release a free antivirus suite for consumers. The program is codenamed Morrow, and it's got the feathers of the AV vendors all in a flutter. Joining me now to discuss Morrow is Julie Atella, who is Microsoft's Director of Product Marketing for Windows. And she'll talk about the implications, if any, for the enterprise. Julia, is Morrow just purely a consumer play, or is this something that'll be available to enterprise as well?
Morrow will actually be focused and targeted at consumers only. Our goal actually is to get that 60%, 50 to 60%, depending on which market you're in, of consumers protected who are not protected today.
Okay, so I bet there's some disappointed enterprise people out there who are hoping to get some free desktop signature-based AV. That's obviously not the plan.
It's not the plan. I mean, if there are businesses, particularly smaller businesses, who want to use a free solution that doesn't require centralized management or different things like that, then certainly there's no way we're going to police that, and we want to make sure people are protected. But enterprises really seem to have a much higher degree of requirements, particularly around centralized deployment, centralized management, things like that.
As far as the Morrow license goes, would it be illegal or a violation of your licensing terms for someone to actually use it in the enterprise?
We haven't actually written those licensing agreements yet, but no, there I don't believe there would be at this point in time.
I wonder whether or not someone in the enterprise would be tempted to actually use it for that very basic function and perhaps write their own scripting tools to deploy it to desktops and manage it centrally.
They potentially could, although I would imagine, again, we haven't written the licensing agreements yet, so I don't know specifically what that'll do. I do know when we think about today, if an enterprise actually rolls something out centrally, if they have an enterprise solution that they roll out, something like Forefront, and then individual computers try to run something else, it causes all kinds of, you know, haywire activity on the computer. So we definitely would only want them running one at a time. And I think we'll probably have to cross that bridge as we get to it, or if we get to it from an enterprise perspective. I do think most enterprises would probably want to continue with a solution that gives them more of that central deployment and central management control.
Well, that what you're saying there is very much in line with what the AV players are saying. We had a guy from Symantec on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that, you know, this is really just a very basic function designed for consumers. In fact, they went further and said that this is an acknowledgement by Microsoft that they made an inferior product, and this is their exit. This is Microsoft's exit from the security market. I don't think it'd be too much of a stretch to take a guess and say that you disagree with that.
You could probably say that. I actually think this shows that we're even more committed to consumer security than we were before. We as we looked at all of the data, and I think you've actually talked with the Trustworthy Computing team as well in the past, and so you've seen a lot of the security intelligence report data that they put out. And as we look at the way that the threats are evolving and they're moving up the stack, you know, it's great that we're making improvements in the operating system with Windows. But that just means that threats are moving up the stack, and we're finding that consumers worldwide just aren't protected, a large percentage of them. And some of it's laziness, some of it's that they just don't know, they're not aware, they're confused, they think they have it because they had a trial when they bought their PC, all of those different things. Or, you know, maybe they had it at one point in time and it slowed down their PC because they were running a suite, or they were running something that really required a lot of bandwidth on their machine, or even bandwidth on their internet connectivity. And so our goal actually is to reach that 60% of consumers who aren't protected today.
So that's a statistic, is it? 60% of consumers aren't using any AV at all?
You know, it varies by market, and so I kind of am averaging out 60%. But in developed markets, it tends to be in the 50 to 60% range that are not protected today. And, you know, if you think about the flip side of that, when you ask consumers if they think they have up-to-date antivirus or anti-malware protection on their machine, anywhere from 80 to 90% of consumers will say that they do. So it shows that there's this confusion or lack of awareness out there of whether or not they truly do. In developing markets, in a lot of the emerging markets, that number is even higher because they can't afford it, or their PCs are lower performance PCs that just can't handle a lot of the pay-for-play security suites.
Now, I imagine many of the statistics that you've just cited have come from the amazing telemetry that is available to Microsoft since the release of the malware removal tool. Is that correct?
Malicious software removal tool, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I imagine that gave you guys maybe a bit of a shock.
Well, we definitely used that telemetry. We also looked at third-party data as well. One of the good things that we'll see with hopefully broader adoption with the free solution is we'll get a little more access into telemetry in emerging markets where we don't have a lot of data today. And then that data will go into improving the engine both on the consumer side and for our enterprise products.
Okay. Now, look, this isn't the first free desktop antivirus that's been available to consumers. Of course, AVG Free has rocketed in popularity, particularly over the last few years. Are you surprised that more people haven't installed that particular solution? What makes you think that people will opt for the Microsoft solution when there's already a widely accepted package out there?
Well, we're hopeful, particularly in markets where AVG isn't a known brand, we're hopeful that the Microsoft brand will help us there, help us get more consumers protected. We also, when we look at a lot of those free solutions, many of them actually will provide the free solution and use that as a precursor to upgrade you to a for-fee subscription. And so we're hoping that that having a free anti-malware solution out there with no strings attached will hopefully be incentive for more consumers to be more protected.
Now, it hasn't been an easy run for your desktop antivirus products. Critics didn't really like OneCare that much. Do you think Microsoft could have done better with the initial development of OneCare?
I think if you look 2 years ago when OneCare first launched, I think you're right. There were reviewers out there who weren't super keen on OneCare. But if you look at the last 12 to 16 months, the core anti-malware engine in OneCare has improved dramatically. And we actually have seen reviewers, a lot of our reviews have been much more positive. We've seen many of the third-party certification authorities like ICSA Labs and the VB100 and things like that are really ranking us up there with a lot of the major competitors that are out there.
In terms of your spending on anti-malware and on particularly things like signature development, things like that. I mean, obviously that was very easy to justify when OneCare was bringing in some revenue. Now that it's not, do you plan to actually cut spending or less aggressively ramp up your spending in that space?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, our forefront enterprise line of security products is still out there and growing rapidly, and so the core anti-malware engine and developing there and R&D around that will still be critical. And as I mentioned, you know, in order for us to actually build a quality product that consumers will want to use, it has to be a core quality anti-malware engine. And the higher quality we make the engine, the better telemetry we have, the better Windows experience consumers have, and it'll just keep feeding that that growth and that improvement in the engine.
Will there be an equivalent enterprise version? Do you still plan on selling or making available for sale some sort of product which uses the same sort of signatures that is centrally manageable?
We absolutely will continue to sell the Forefront line of products. In Forefront Client Security, they have both the anti-malware engine that we use in OneCare today, plus that will be used as the basis for the engine in the new product. And then they also pull in a number of other AV signature providers. So they have a multiple set of AV signature providers in Forefront Client Security.
What do you make of the response of companies like McAfee and Symantec, who are really talking down your consumer, free consumer solution? Do you think this is a case of them trying to damage the brand to shore up their own sales?
Well, I can't really comment for Symantec and McAfee. You'll have to ask them if you haven't already. But our goal is actually to make sure we get more consumers more protected, because the more protected our Windows users are, the better their experiences with Windows.
So we shouldn't necessarily look at this as a major switch or a sign of a major future change to the enterprise suite of products.
I wouldn't know. I mean, as far as I know, the Forefront team is still plan of record moving forward with all of the great things that they've been doing and have been planning to do. And I think once we have more details to share on exactly what will be in Morrow and when it'll be available and all of that, we'll be able to provide better guidance around, here's what Morrow will do, you know, the product code name Morrow, here's what Forefront Client Security does, here's the differences, here's why it makes sense for you to go with the Forefront line of products versus a free product. And we just don't have that level of detail to share right now.
What's the development timeline like, though?
Right now, we're saying that we will release the new product in the second half of 2009, and we're hoping to have a beta or a pilot in the first half of 2009.
Julia Teller, thank you very much for speaking to Risky Business.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Julia Atala from Microsoft there. I think I called her Julie at the end there, so sorry about that, Julia. Now, this week's Sound Foundation track that you can hear now is Wildflower by Meme, and you can buy it at soundfoundation.com.au as a DRM free MP3. I'll be back with another show soon, and I'll also be podcasting a couple of the RuxCon talks. And I'd like to say a special hello while I've got the opportunity to all of the listeners I met at RuxCon. It was really great to meet all you guys and girls, and thank you very much for all of your continued support. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks a lot for listening.
recognize one thing as good. They also recognize another thing as evil. What is difficult and what is easy arise together. Long and short are in relation to each other. High and low depend on one another. Forward and backward lead to each other. Forward and backward lead to each other. Forward and backward. Those who are glad are welcomed by gladness. Those who are sad are welcomed by sadness.
I saw you crying, and I saw you responding. But I was just about to bust wide open. You're talking about being moved.